Campus FM presents a talk by Patricia Camilleri with the title War in Malta's Museums. The talk was organised by the Archaeological Society.
Thank you very much. There are two articles actually in the book. One is Collecting Yourself and the other is the title of this evening's talk, which is War in Malta's Museums. The aim of this talk this evening is really to briefly touch on the historical narrative of the museum, to look at one or two aspects of collective memory and shared trauma in a war museum context, to talk about a few of Malta's museums with collections that include representations of war. Clearly, this is a huge subject, so I was already limited in the chapter, and I'm certainly limited this evening by time constraints. I'm always looking for tools with which to analyse museums, because it's all very well saying, well, you go to a museum, then you must be aware, and you must look at this and that, but sometimes it's useful to have tools. And I came across the work of a museologist in Belgium at the Catholic University of Leuven called Pascal Gleilen. And he's done some empirical research in his area, and he's identified, with reference to historical philosophy and literary theory, different approaches to the space-time continuum, which is really the central concept when you're looking at museums of this nature. And he's devised these three categories: local time, global time, and glocal time. Very briefly, because obviously I don't have time to go into it much, local time he considers chronological or linear time, the attempt to present facts, in inverted commas. Global time is illustrated by museums that are often placed in simulated historical scenery, such as Disneyland or mini Europe, that could be anywhere really in the world. And museums that would reflect glocal time focus on the existence of many experienced pasts and is open-ended. I'd just like to mention him because he's a sort of leitmotif that runs through the chapter and partly tonight's talk. A brief word, very brief word, about early museums that have informed really the shape of war museums today. Museums in their early form of Cabinet of Curiosities and even in their later manifestations such as the Louvre and the British Museum were as much as anything an attempt to organise the world, to catalogue new discoveries, to understand the enormous variety of plants and animals, as well as the geology, the dates of which we were being pushed always further and further backwards. They were an attempt to rationalise the world and to make sense of what was potentially really a frightening environment. And it must have been disturbing for some people. I was interested to note in my reading that J.S. Mill's On Liberty was printed in the same year as On the Origin of the Species. That was 1859. Both really held potentially very disturbing ideas for society. In a way, one could argue that while the early catalogue collections tried to rationalise world order, war museums are also a tool in which there is an attempt to rationalise, perhaps, war itself. While many might say that, of course, war doesn't have much to be rational about, it is, however, something that humankind has been practising since time immemorial, and this new century has certainly seen its fair share of civil, international, internecine, terroristic, genocidal war, and much ink has flowed, just trying to justify all kinds of warfare. But the brutal truth of death and the waste of young lives, both civilian and military, cannot be swept under the carpet. Museums are a treasure house of memory, but they are also memory creators. And that creativity is as much expressed by the omissions as by that which is included. Those omitted text and artifacts could be said to be marginalized, but having a value not least owing to their marginalization. And this is important when considering the problems of museums commemorating war in its various forms. War has so many different faces. It is death and destruction. It is loss and misery. It's glory. It's victory. It's bravery. Not only does it carry with it a baggage of emotions, but it covers a wide range of cultural representations, such as army life, traditions, conscientious objection, and myriad others. It is clear, then, that a museum would be hard-pressed to cover every aspect of war and would therefore have to make choices in what it manifests and what it does not emphasize. There are many different types of war museum. Many of you will have visited Ypres, the Imperial War Museum, the Holocaust Museums, and a host of others. Some war museums, such as the Red Cross and Red Crescent in Geneva, focus on the horrors of war, on the degradation of our humanity through torture and killing. They make a moral judgment, if not about war per se, then undoubtedly about certain practices associated with it. The words of Dostoevsky, "Everyone is responsible to everyone for everything," are engraved at the entrance to the Red Cross and Red Crescent Museum in Geneva. After a visit to the museum, I staggered out and made a beeline for a stiff gin and tonic, totally convinced of the desperate need for sentiments of love and solidarity. And if that's what the curators were striving to achieve on that occasion, I think they reached their goal admirably. However, turning to the Maltese context, we can encounter a certain blurring of the time-space continuum. Barring the Second World War, the most celebrated war ever fought on Maltese soil, of course, is the Great Siege of 1565. It has been celebrated and sung about, as well as illustrated by some of the most brilliant European intellectuals and artists, Goethe, Schiller, just to name two. The Turks take, of course, a somewhat different view and tend to downgrade the event, but as usually happens, and has been famously said before, this battle was written about chiefly by the winners. The mythic record of the Great Siege is, to a great extent, still retained in the Maltese collective memory. Early chroniclers, with the exception of Balbi di Correggio, tended to emphasize the moral victory of Christianity over Ottoman forces and the Turks. And to quote Bluet from his The Story of Malta, "While the Maltese make up the cast of thousands, the starring roles are played by the knights." In fact, had the Turks won the siege of 1565, in Bluet's opinion, and not only his, it would probably not have spelled the end of the Knights of St. John and would almost certainly not have led to an automatic introduction of Ottoman Turks into the mainland Europe from the south. However, the idea that the Great Siege may have stemmed Ottoman advance into Europe is still prevalent in the collective memory. And the heroic deeds of particular Maltese soldiers, such as Lu Abriffa and Tony Bayada, have always been sung about, but the important role played by the whole Maltese populace in stemming the Turkish invasion on various fronts is one that has taken hold of the collective imagination rather more slowly. The change in attitudes towards the participation of the Maltese soldier in times of conflict, as well as towards objects of historical significance, finds several examples in Malta. After the Second World War, there was understandably a desire to move on from the years of discomfort and at times genuine hunger. The gun emplacements were dismantled and the military hardware removed from different areas of the island. Often all that remained was the concrete supporting structure and a few iron bars. One such gun post was sited on the top of the hill above the valley known as Wirtor Lea, which is now the home of the University of Maltrit and Sida. The gun post lay slightly outside the original building area in 1968, but with the building of the Faculty of Architecture and Civil Engineering, this gun post found itself within the footprint of the faculty. And what in the past would have been considered a superfluous piece of iron and concrete is now considered contemporary archaeology, and it was decided to preserve it. It was covered with a removable roof and is now used as a lecture room, while the bunker, where it is recorded that a soldier died after a direct hit, is now used as a model project office. And the same sort of thing has happened in the case of the wartime shelters. After the Second World War, the shelters were all blocked up and forgotten, but in recent years, especially with the development of the local councils around Malta and Gozo, there is a renewed interest in the social aspects of wartime Malta, and the shelters have now been open to the public and are considered an important aspect of local identity. The shelters hold an interesting element of social levelling because they are a shared experience for all the members of the Maltese society who were alive at the time. When the bombs started to fall, the shelters became the bolt hole of gentry and commoner alike. This shared trauma of the war in Malta is potently symbolized by Operation Pedestal and the Santa Maria convoy. It looms large in every Maltese museum or exhibition dealing with the Second World War and represents the lowest and highest points of Malta's morale. These two extremes of emotion give it a special place in the memory of all those who were in Malta at the time of the convoy's arrival in the Grand Harbour. The National War Museum dedicates a section to large contemporary photographs of the convoy, as does the Maritime Museum in the rooms dedicated to the British Navy in Malta. It is also mentioned in the fascinating war rooms at Lascaris Wharf. These war rooms deserve particular attention in the context of memory, because here we have a veritable time warp. Malta's war rooms are one of only five in Europe that have not been dismantled. Others include those in Gibraltar, which are not open to the public, and of course the war rooms in Whitehall, famously reopened by Maggie Thatcher in the 80s. Lascaris war rooms can be reached by passing under the huge arches which support the main road leading into Valletta. The narrow covered passage has been left more or less as it was in the war years, with grey iron doors to left and right. The rooms, originally used as slaves' quarters and stores by the knights, were fashioned out of the bare rock at that time. The entrance is small and unadorned, and the visitor can choose to use an audio cassette during the visit or to ask for a guided tour. The British divided this huge and supremely bomb-proof warehouse into sections and built a gallery which runs down the sides of the rooms in such a way that the commanding officers could watch what was happening on the tables below. There was a chain of command and communication which was strictly controlled, and secrecy was paramount. Today, the sections and tables are peopled by mannequins, but the museum curators have tried their best to recreate the tense atmosphere of the period. The official guide is quite delightful in his enthusiasm, and he too tries to recount both the military and naval aspects, as well as the effect on the civil population. His anecdotes are the result of the comments made to him by many British visitors, survivors of the Second World War very often, and some who actually served in the war rooms. The site needs constant and costly maintenance and is by nature rather dank. However, as a testimony, the war rooms are perhaps the most tangible that one can now have of that aspect of the Second World War in Malta. Two questions really come to mind when touring the war rooms. The first concerns the nature of the audience at this exhibition, and the second involves issues of mediation. The statistics available from the National Statistics Office regarding audience numbers do not give a breakdown of nationality, but one can safely presume, I think, that the vast majority of visitors would not be Maltese citizens. So one might ask, what messages are being emitted by the war rooms and to whom? A visitor might imagine, for example, that the women who staffed the plotting rooms were British, but that is not necessarily true. The guide does mention, in fact, that most of the women plotters were Maltese girls, and it is known that when the war broke out, the British women and children were all sent home. One might imagine they were wrens or racks. Of interest in this context is the comment by Mr. Charles Thake during an interview when he speaks about the author Ernley Bradford, and he says, and I quote, "Everybody who has been through the war should write about what we have been through, because people won't really care about us Maltese, and they never really did. This gentleman, Ernley Bradford, who wrote The Siege of Malta, of course, states in his book, a dear friend of mine with whom I worked at the British Institute was working on plotting duties, and she was given an MBE, member of the British Empire. Charles Stake's answer to that is, well, very good, thank you very much. But he was describing the E-boat attack on the Grand Harbour, and this is what he wrote, Charles Stake wrote, in the margin of the book. Bradford, as an officer of the Royal Navy, should have known that others than his British friend were... there were other people other than his British friend who were distinguishing themselves, who didn't get the MBE. He mentions his colleague, Colonel Ferro, a schoolmate from St. Edward's, who was an officer in the 1st Coastal Royal Regiment when this attack happened. And it was the 1st Coastal Royal Regiment that fired 6-pounder guns on those ships. And it was the Maltese who were on leave who rushed to the guns to give the necessary assistance to the Maltese colleagues. And Colonel Ferro became a priest and died a priest, and he never got the MBE. In the case of the war rooms, local time, that is chronological development of linear time, is limited to those years of World War II, with special emphasis being given to the Annus Horribilis 1942, when Malta was the most bombed place on Earth. The artifacts that are on show, such as out-of-date telephones and plotting mechanisms, which included pieces of string, take on a major role in the discourse of the whole war museum's experience. Visitors marvel at the precision that was clearly made possible despite the very basic types of communications techniques. The geographical setting is very present in this context because the whole area is full of maps which place the islands of Malta and Gozo within the Mediterranean context, but which focus particularly on the gun capacity of the island. Global time, as described by Glyland, the guy I mentioned before, is usually exemplified in the Total Experience Museum. But the war museums also are total experience, but they are almost the real experience. There's no need to add scent because you can smell probably the original damp smell that you could smell 60 years ago. And it's definitely within a genuine historical context, and placed precisely within timeline parameters. The war rooms also fit into the concept of global time because they link into a connection with war in general, and particularly with the war between the Allies and the Axis powers, the tables reflect that conflict as it was happening at the time. The place is staged and dramatized through the artifacts that are displayed on it. But far from being a closed environment, here's the idea of narrative open-endedness. The whole exhibition of the war rooms is not affected by a sense of closure, strangely enough, because the people who visit the museum participate in its development. The anecdotes of war veterans and their families inform the guide and contribute to further knowledge about the events. The air control system is original, and having been taken off a ship destined for the scrapyard in the late 30s, it probably dates back to the very early part of the 20th century. It still functions perfectly, but it has the help of an electric extractor fan and pump, modern-day accessories. The war rooms may be caught in a contemporary time warp, but their narrative is growing and changing with every visitor that enters. This is the dialogue with the past about which Glyland speaks when he states, and I quote, "The historical staging is literally presented as dependent on time and place. From this grows the realization that the past is time and time again given meaning by an ever-moving present. Memory, after all, is always of the present, even though its ostensible content is of the past," Hewison tells us. Memory has been much discussed over the years, but what emerges out of these discussions is that memory is a complex, manipulative concept which is influenced by circumstance, social pressure, and even individual need. The recollection of war may be very different when experienced just a few years after the event compared to the view of the same person might have some 20 or 50 years on. However, it seems clear that the mediation of an audience will influence each visitor and affect what she or he will take away from the display. An aware and prepared audience will be able to identify what they perceive as lacunae or inaccuracies, and in some cases will subvert the intentions of the curator. Let's just set a scene. A 50-year-old woman enters the War Museum in Valletta and heads straight for some photographs hanging on one of the walls. Her eyes focus directly on a black and white shot of the 2nd Battalion Royal Irish Fusiliers receiving shamrock on St. Patrick's Day in 1942. A man in a captain's uniform stands proudly to attention in the front row. The visitor smiles as she enjoys the familiarity of the moment, and because she knows that on a St. Patrick's Day, some years later, that captain became her father. What does the Valletta War Museum mean to her? What does the Second World War mean to her? For this particular visitor, it means a love story and the privilege of being born. Of course, the curator of the museum can have no idea, as he or she surveys the rather traditional display, that she has created the coordinates for such an understanding. The work of any museum curator is, in many respects, serendipitous. She or he creates a display according to a theme, a philosophy, sometimes even an ideology. And yet, those parameters can be extended simply through human intervention. Kavanagh, a museologist, well-known museologist, refers to the action of history curators and suggests that they choose artifacts that which have evidence value at some level. But the same could be said of non-professional initiators such as Mr. Thake and his friends involved in the very early days of the setting up of the National War Museum. His personal collection, and a few pieces can be seen above, seems eclectic, probably because there are items which are valuable historically, a Bakelite model aeroplane from HMS Illustrious, for instance, and others which are imbued with value because of their connection with a particular action or person or community. It is probable that the structure of the War Museum collection reflects that same dichotomy. Mr. Thake and other enthusiasts of war memorabilia were determined to retain, through the establishment of a war museum, the memory of those physical objects which were important to them. Perhaps we can have a closer look at the National War Museum itself. It is based in an iconic military building in Valletta. Fort St. Elmo is emblematic of the conflict between besieged and besieger. Using glocal time, the collective memory incorporates the last stand made by the Knights and Maltese against the invading Turks in 1565 with the second siege of 1942. The theme of sacrifice was writ large on the walls of the fort long before the Second World War. That memory was clearly reinforced by the part that was played during the Battle of Valletta. The two sieges are celebrated on the Feast of Our Lady of Victories, September the 8th, with a public holiday. The twin association at a religious level enhances the connection and helps to create an historical concertina effect. The War Museum is currently made up of brief information panels, contemporary photographs, etc. Pieces of Gloucester Gladiator, of course the famous one, Faith, a siren, bullets, shells, and a plethora of other items. Although the overarching theme is the Second World War, the collection is eclectic, really, in the same way that Mr. Thake's is, because many of the items, in fact, have been donated by collectors such as himself. The itinerary is a fairly rigid one, indicated with the sign, "Please start from the left." And indeed, the display is basically chronological, but does include some time jumps where the theme supersedes the overall storyline. I don't have time this evening to give a detailed description of the display, but would encourage those of you who have never been to the National War Museum, or may not have been for some time, to take some time out to visit it. The various sections are extremely interesting in their own ways. The timeline associated with the National War Museum is, like the war rooms, chiefly restricted to the war years 41, 42 and 43. However, the military and naval connections between the British and the Maltese are, as we have said, previous to those years and continue for some time afterwards. No doubt meetings are still held by members of the disbanded KOMR. So the community of knowledge that both foreign and local visitors have and adhere to is much wider than the timeline expressed in the museum itself. Being a microcosm with all the accoutrements of a sovereign state, Malta can express a nationalized entity while admitting also to regional town-village differences and at the same time connect to a wider political context. The National War Museum does not go out of its way to place the Second World War in a context wider than that of the Maltese Islands. It is, in a sense, a geopolitical sense, a little bit insular, but it does try to re-evoke those fearful years through descriptions both of heroism and misery borne by both the British and the Maltese civil population. Towards the end of the itinerary, there are some icons of the Second World War and Malta's participation, a bust of Sir Winston Churchill, a detailed description of Operation Pedestal, and in a special niche of its own, of course, the George Cross, presented to the island in Malta, of Malta in 1942, together with the citation signed by King George VI. The museum's position at St. Elmo gives it an aura of genuineness. Part of its charm lies in the fact that it looks as though it's been put together with the enthusiasm of knowledgeable amateurs. When it receives, as eventually it must, an injection of funds that will bring it up to contemporary museum standards, one feels that it will, sadly, lose some of the sense of the genuine. I recently expressed this view to the present curator through an email and was pleased when he agreed with these sentiments. That rough and ready presentation is now part of the National War Museum's narrative. But war is present also in some rather unlikely places. Maltese towns and villages have always felt themselves to be individual islands of Maltese culture. Their noisy feasts and their connections with individual grandmasters have given them a sense of identity separate to each other. Regional accents can still be heard in the Maltese languages and in language in almost all villages. And the rise of local councils has helped nurture the sense of village identity, and many councils are now developing museums and archaeological or historical sites that focus on the local area. And I'll just give two examples, one a parochial church museum and another supported by a local council. The Zabara Sanctuary Museum contains an eclectic selection of artifacts which represent the ecclesiastical and secular history of the town of Zabar. Purpose-built in the 1950s by the then parish priest Monsignor Joseph Zarb, this museum was extremely innovative for its time. It seems that on taking office, Monsignor Zarb was amazed at the amount of items that were kept in cupboards, corners and darkened rooms, and he managed to obtain funds to erect a building to house them. Inevitably, many of the items on display illustrate stages in the development of the parish church, processional objects, and the like. However, memories of the Second World War are never far from the Zabar people, since they were so close to the harbour and suffered great losses themselves. On the upper floor, there are two display cases showing photographs of local military men with their medals. Here one could say that there is an attempt to illustrate the bravery of both civilian and military components of the local Zabar society. The museum building has recently been renovated at great cost, and it is interesting to note that the second floor includes a very contemporary coloured steel-framed mezzanine floor. The semiotics of this new floor, which incorporates a sweeping wooden staircase, are clear. The message is one of grandeur and modernity, an affirmation of the significance of the artifacts displayed and the importance that the church authorities want to afford the community. Whereas many museums worldwide try to evoke history from within a 21st century milieu, The Maltese museums dealing with war are almost without exception embedded into an historical context. The buildings they occupy are historic, and they are surrounded physically by other old buildings that are all strong references to the past. In the case of the Malta at War Museum at Birgu, the museum itself is placed in part of the town's bastions built in the 17th century and are atop the warren of Second World War shelters. It is significant to note that the Malta at War Museum is run by Fondazione Wirtartner, a national charity active in the field of cultural heritage preservation, in conjunction with the Malta Tourism Authority, and is managed in collaboration with the Vittoriosa Local Council. This symbiosis is an eloquent example of how such museums are being created and maintained today. Many of Vittoriosa's inhabitants left when the bombing raid started in 1941, but some remained. Many of these were workers who manned the dockyard facilities and were instrumental in keeping the British naval vessels afloat. During the raids, they were all forced to seek refuge underground. This tunneling effort could be said to be a metaphor for the toughness of the local people in the face of adversity. For many years, the idea of living like troglodytes in an underground cavern must have seemed almost like a disgrace, but those feelings have now given way to a certain pride, and such shelters are turning into reference points, as we said, of local and national identity, as well as a source of income. In some significant way, the shelters are more of a memorial commemorating those who lost their lives than the many traditional war memorials that can be found in the towns and villages. One can imagine that the shelters would be of more interest to a younger audience than a list of names on a slab of white marble. The idea of a memorial is fed by memory, but it is also manipulated by it. For the post-independence youth of Malta, many would say that it is important to see service to the country as something given willingly, and this is manifested in the idea of all being in the war effort together, British or Maltese, against a common enemy. Various things work against the promulgation of this idea, not least the wartime internment in Uganda of those people perceived by the British to be pro-Italian. Perhaps, as Mr. Thaik intimated in his interview, certain memories of the British have been suppressed by those writing about the second siege of Malta. Talking about omitting important information, he states, "But sometimes they, the books, were by other people, not pro-British. And one of these was an officer in the Royal Australian Air Force, and he couldn't care less about what other people wrote. And he gave us a very important photograph, which I shall show you. In Ta'ali Airdrome, we had the most important things, the hurricanes and the Spitfires, and the commander of the aerodrome at Ta'ali decided that he was going to be very hard on the Maltese, those people who were standing cheek by jowl with the British. So he built a gibbet, which you see here in the photograph." And at this point, I must say, the interviewer laughed slightly. "It's very serious," he replied. "Read the caption. The gallows and noose erected at Ta'ali by Wing Commander Brady to back his threat of execution for any act of sabotage." Mr. Thaik feels that certain attitudes towards the Maltese have been quietly eradicated from the record. One cannot help but wonder if this kind of behaviour has not found its way into the history books because of the desire to retain a myth woven through the mediation of historians, together, one could add, with the compliance, perhaps, of the Maltese audience as well. Previously, it may not have seemed appropriate to mention gibbets and lack of MBEs. After all, had the George Cross not been given to the Maltese people? However, as the Second World War moves further into the linear past, it is inevitable that shifting identities, through, among other things, access to media such as the web, will create different ways of interpreting behaviours, both those of the British and of the Maltese, and even the Irish Fusilier's daughter will have to contend with those changes. Thank you.
You have just listened to a talk by Patricia Camilleri with the title War in Malta's Museums. The talk was organized by the Archaeological Society.